Florida firefighters are close to getting medical help from the state. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There's a bill now on the governor's desk that provides medical care for firefighters diagnosed with cancer. We'll talk with a Wellington Democrat behind the bill. He's an active firefighter himself. Also, climate change is leading to warmer temperatures and rising seas. Researchers are now looking at how melting polar caps are impacting the paths and intensity of storms. We'll talk with one researcher about what they've found so far and where the science could be updated. And a new musical at the Colony Theater takes us to a village in the jungles of Venezuela. La Paranda is an immersive show where the audience could find itself on stage dancing and eating. But first, we'll get an update on everything happening in Venezuela today. It's been reported members of the military are joining Juan Guaido in an uprising. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, as the Florida legislature is about to wrap up its 2019 session, Florida firefighters could have reason to celebrate. A study from the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health tracked thousands of firefighters and found that cancer rates were much higher for this group than the general population. Well, a new bill will help firefighters and their families with health care costs and expenses. It would also streamline the process for proving that cancer is job-related. We're joined now by the man behind this bill, Representative Matt Wilhite. He's a Democrat from Wellington, and he's joining us now. Representative Wilhite, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me.
Tell us real briefly what this law would provide for firefighters.
Well, you know, currently, and I'm not the only one behind it, there's an entire Florida legislature behind this, and I thank you for that, that comment, but it takes a whole legislature to do stuff, and I'm so proud that we're saying to our firefighters that we're supporting them and their families if they're struck with a disease that's related to, their cancer related to them working. But, you know, firefighters are so much more at risk right now. Numbers are every two out of three firefighters in the state of Florida could contract or have a form of cancer. And so the state of Florida has done a lot of study with the University of Miami. We've done a lot of research. And so what we're saying is that if you contract one of 21 cancers that are clearly identified, the state of Florida will recognize those as a work-related injury. And we will allow you to, and the hope is that they'll claim that on their private insurance. And then they will go see their doctor. They'll be treated. At that time, they will get a one-time payment of $25,000 given to them to help with travel expenses and maybe a hotel stay if they have to go stay somewhere. You know, we have some great cancer facilities around the state that do a lot of this treatment. They'll get, you know, that'll help them to offset some of those costs. And they'll treat this like a work-related injury.
And does this also help firefighters who are already retired who haven't been on the force in a long time?
Well, so what the bill says is that after 10 years after retirement, you are still able to claim if you have one of those 21 cancers. So, yes.
You said, you know, and we've looked at the statistics that, you know, that again, firefighters at greater risk for different types of cancer, many different types of cancer than the general population. Do you have a personal connection to this? I'd imagine you know somebody.
Well, I know quite a few people. I'm in my 24th year with the fire department. I work for Palm Beach County Fire Rescue, where I serve as a captain, station captain. In that career, I've seen a lot of, and I still work. I'm still the only active firefighter in the Florida legislature, or ever. And over that career, I've seen a lot of people get sick. I've seen a lot of people struck with cancer. You know, they can't come to work. They're getting chemotherapy or radiation treatment. And how are they expected to come to work and carry an air pack and climb up five stories of a building to rescue somebody or to put a fire out when this treatment just knocks the wind out of them completely? And so it's very difficult. And I see how many of them have either had to leave the profession or unfortunately we've lost some and they die from cancer. You know, just think about in the city of Miami, 37-year-old man at the prime of his life. Him and his wife are married. His wife is 7 months pregnant. He's diagnosed with brain cancer and dies. This is what firefighters and the reality of what they're dealing with right now.
When you first became a firefighter, when you first got into this, and again, going back many years now, as you said, what were the conversations like? I mean, was there talk about cancer? Was there talk about, you know, that concern, that fear?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I went to the fire academy. Well, it must be about 27 years ago. I wasn't hired right away, and I worked on that. But, we were worried about, a roof collapse on you, or, falling down a staircase, or, actually getting burned in a fire and things. Cancer was never any discussion that we had. We even to the fact thought that it was really cool that if our helmet got really dirty from a fire, or our gear was dirty, or we had soot on our face or under our nose where we breathe it, that, you just fought, a strong fire, and you hopefully did everything you could to save lives or property. But when you came out as a firefighter, it was like a badge of honor. And we've realized today that that was just putting us more at risk.
And so, when did that change? When did that idea of like, this is the tough guy firefighter, the heroic firefighter, and if you're not, as you said, if you don't come out looking like you just fought this massive blaze, when did that change to realize, wait a minute, this is dangerous for us?
We started with an iteration of this bill was filed in 2004. So, maybe 10, 15 years ago, we started to really realize. And probably I would say within the last 5 to 6 years, we've really, really taken a concerted effort. We've, again, done this study and research with the University of Miami. We're trying to do best management practices. We're changing. Don't forget, we're trying to change a career, a field that's been around for a long time. And, to have firefighters take showers immediately, to do decon, to change out their gear, to change their hoods, to go back to the station and take showers immediately afterwards. They're going as far as using like saunas and exercise bicycles to try and make you sweat more now to get that out of your pores, because that's the biggest area that we're finding that it's entering our body. We wear air packs now.
Yeah.
And so it's not lung cancer that we're finding. It's skin cancer. It's all these others. Again, these 21 identified cancers that are finding because of the absorption into the single largest organ in our body, which is our skin.
And you said this goes back really to 2004, but why is it taken to 2019 before we finally said, yes, we need to protect firefighters?
Well, I don't think there's any specific one reason. I think that obviously we needed to have research and data to show that's what it was. I mean, the general public can get cancer as well as anybody else, and it would not be fair for any elected body that deals with people's tax dollars to say that, that we should automatically cover any individual or profession. We needed to have the proof and the data and the backup, and we've done that, and we've proved it, and we've gotten to the point now where us and many other states realize that this is a fact of today's fires. It's the byproducts of today's fires of that weren't of yesterday's, where it used to be true natural products of wood and stuff, and now we're dealing with so many synthetic things, styrofoams and plastics and all those other things that are much more deadly to us, that we've found that through time, not only has the fire changed, but the products of combustion have changed. And that's why it's become so much more dangerous in the profession.
All right. So this is now going to the governor's desk. But early on in the session, there were issues in the House that this might not even go anywhere. There's a long story behind this. And, I'm going to try to, not allow it to be too convoluted, but it had been reported that perhaps Republican House Speaker Jose Oliva of Miami Springs was the reason why it wasn't it didn't have any traction in the House at the beginning. And there were claims that the Speaker tried to destroy the bill because of his, I guess, he had issues with the firefighters union. But had you spoken with the Speaker? What was that all about?
I think the Speaker has a lot of responsibilities to the state of Florida. We're the third largest state in the nation. He has a lot of responsibilities to every person, every occupation, every person out there. I think that we scrutinize all bills that are filed by the 120 House members. It's just a matter of getting through the process and making sure that things are in a correct posture, and that we do what's best. And what we find out, like I say, financially and all those different things with research and data and backup to make sure. I can't confirm any of that other issues of things that happened, but I know that where we are today is that the bill is sitting on the governor's desk and we're waiting for him to sign it, which is going to be a statement to firefighters and their families that Florida is behind the firefighters that are here to protect the residents and citizens of Florida, the visitors, that if they are contracting any kind of these cancers while in the line of their duty, that we're going to try and assist them as much as possible and do the right thing for them.
I'm talking with Representative Matt Wilhite, Democrat from Wellington, author, well, one of the sponsors, I should say. Many people were on this bill that is now, again, as he mentioned, going to the governor's desk. This provides medical coverage for firefighters diagnosed with many different types of cancers, over 20 different types of cancers, and, of course, also helping their families financially. I wanted to go to one of the challenges before is firefighters had to find a way to prove that their cancer is job-related. That's now off the table, right?
Well, you know, I mean, it's our responsibility as firefighters to take every safety precaution and measure we can. We can't have an employer giving us the equipment and the gear and the procedures to do the right thing and then contracting an issue if we didn't do everything on our part as firefighters. And so, again, changing not just our employer, but changing our employees' mindsets and how we deal with firefighters and post-fires to do that. And so we have done that now. We've, again, all these departments around the state with support of our state fire marshal has, you know, issued decon kits to all these departments. And they've told them and put in writing and procedures and the best management practices about what to do to try and make sure that firefighters are the best protected when they do have to fight these fires. And so it's taken a little bit of time, and the burden was on firefighters and their industry a little bit. And so we've done that. And so hopefully now that we did that, and like I said, with the University of Miami study and research where they do, blood testing on us and so many different things, the University of Miami Sylvester Cancer Research Center has done. And we've come to the conclusion, yes, firefighters are more at risk for these 21 types of cancer. And so the state now, it doesn't matter the time frame, they've said that we want to protect these firefighters. And they put a large investment into it, like I say, because they were funding some of this research through the University of Miami. And so they got everything they needed, and they came together this year. And again, the House of Representatives, the Senate have passed it, and the governor, we are awaiting his signature. Hopefully, we're hoping by the end of this week.
You know, I'd read a number of reports looking around from the last couple of years that looked at how the job of a firefighter has really changed a lot over the years, over the decades. It's very different now than it was 20, 30 years ago. And you understand that better than I ever could. But does that mean that it's harder to recruit? Has that been your experience? What right now, how would you describe the state of, I guess, you know, the firefighter, you know, job?
I've had multiple generations in my family. My cousin today serves as a firefighter in Michigan. It's a profession, first of all, out of love and passion. It's a profession out of service and dedication to the communities that they work for and the people they work for. You know, their friends, neighbors, they're somebody they go to church with or their kid plays baseball on. And so the profession, in my mind, is still a very honorable and professional career. And so we still do have people wanting to get into the job every day. You know, not every single person is set out to go to college. There are still trades and services that are needed in this country. And I believe firefighting is one of those. It's a trade, but it's also a service. And so we still have people every day trying to get, hired. My department, as well as many others, are still hiring regularly. And so this is just something that's telling those new recruits or those people thinking about going into the profession that if I go into it, of course, there's risk. There's risk in every job, but especially in any first responders, with police, fire, medical emergencies, whatever we deal with, there are risks. And but with those risks, there's going to be protections and things put in place to help you should you, deal with one of these issues, such as cancer.
And let me finish with this, because you are in an interesting situation. I mean, you're a firefighter, but you're also a lawmaker, so you understand both sides of that coin. But as a lawmaker, what else do you want to do? This now is, again, at the governor's desk. What else would you like to do to help your brothers and sisters in uniform?
Well, you said, it is my profession, but as a lawmaker, I'm responsible to not only my district, but the 21 million people of Florida. So my job is not to just recognize firefighters and
right.
First responders.
No, understandable.
Right, but I do know firsthand what they deal with. And so last year, I passed a post-traumatic stress disorder bill that helped first responders, all first responders, dealing with, you know, the tragedies that they deal with. You know, these are things every day. You know, our military has done this in battle and finally recognized that the things that, you know, the members of the military see are traumatic to them, and so they're treating them. And so we have the same thing happening in this country. Or in the state that, you know, the, you know, whether it's shootings or domestic violence or the death of a child and those different things. So we've done some of those things to protect them. This is another one, as I say, when we want people to go into the profession, we need to make sure that we protect them and offer them the security that if something happens to them in the line of their job. Now, this isn't everything here we're talking about is they have to have something related to or a
Right.
documented incident or case of something that happened at their job. So, you know, I'll continue to work on those things, but there's been many other things. And I'm working on some healthcare stuff. There's so many other things that affect Floridians nowadays. And so we're working on all those. But yes, of course, I'm not only sympathetic, I'm, you know, firsthand of what happens in our first responder community. And
Right.
so I'm proud to work and represent them because, you know, there's 21, 22,000 professional firefighters in the state of Florida. You know, and all of those, like I say, they live in our neighborhoods and they represent our communities. And I think it's the right thing for us to do.
Yeah, I got to stop you there again. Democratic State Representative Matt Wilhite of Wellington behind the bill, the driving force behind the bill, now going to the governor's desk, again, providing that medical care and support to firefighters who are diagnosed with cancer. You could learn more about the bill, by the way, on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Representative Wilhite, thank you so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come, has the fight to oust Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro reached a turning point? We get an update from our America's editor, Tim Padgett. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the crisis in Venezuela may have reached a new point. Today, people in parts of Caracas stormed different parts of the city, and there have been clashes and gunfire reported. Earlier today, interim president Juan Guaido recorded a video at the Carlota Air Force Base in Caracas, and in it there were heavily armed military forces, or at least people who looked like it, standing with them. And he asked his followers to surround military bases and said this is the time for Maduro to step down. We're joined now by WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett, who's got all the updates on this. All right, this popped up this morning,
right,
Tim, just this video. What's happening though right now?
What's happening right now is that we're seeing skirmishes between President Maduro's forces, National Guard, security forces, particularly in the eastern part of the city, which is the opposition stronghold of Caracas. That's where Juan Guaido has most of his supporters. And there are some military who have defected from the Maduro regime and have joined Guaido and his group out there. But it's not really certain. In fact, it's not really certain at all if that's enough to constitute what we could call a military uprising against the regime. But there has been some violence out there. And in fact, there's one sort of gruesome video of a pro-government military transport truck ramming into a bunch of Guaido supporters as they were throwing rocks at it. And we don't know if there were any injuries or fatalities in that, but it was very shocking to see.
What was in that video that Guaido published this morning? What was he saying?
Well, he was calling on the armed forces of Venezuela to defect from Maduro and join the opposition movement and, in a sense, just overthrow the Maduro regime. This is the key to restoring democracy in Venezuela. It's getting the military to abandon this authoritarian regime led by President Nicolas Maduro and come over to Guaido's side and join him in his effort to establish himself, as he says, the legitimate president of Venezuela.
So he's got a couple of guys in the video who look like they're military.
Right.
But what do we know about who in the military? I mean, and we were talking about specifically leaders who are joined aside.
That's the problem. You just said the key word, leaders. He may have assembled some soldiers around him this morning at Carlota Air Base who have defected from the government. and who are against this regime and the economic disaster that it has caused in Venezuela. But Guaido, to this point, has still not been able to get the high command of the military. There were a lot of reckless rumors this morning, you know, wild rumors flying around that, for example, the armed forces chief of staff, a guy named Ornelas, had come over to Guaido. It turned out to be completely false. He tweeted about 3 hours ago that, no, he was still with Maduro. So I think what Guaido was trying to do this morning was to try to light the fire again in this effort to get the military to rethink its allegiance to Maduro and to try to create cracks in the military that could get enough of these leaders, as you said, to start thinking about coming over to Guaido's side.
Has Maduro said anything or appeared anywhere?
The only real tweet we saw from Maduro this morning, he thanked his high command military leaders for their, quote, nerves of steel in keeping their allegiance to him. And, in fact, the defense minister, Padrino, tweeted a few times this morning that, no, this is just a small fraction of the military that is trying to stage an uprising. We'll put it down. And he also very ominously warned civilians that if they kept up their rock throwing, et cetera, at the military, that he would use armed force against them. And that was a little scary to see.
I did see a tweet that Senator Nelson, Senator Scott.
Scott.
Thank you. Senator Scott was calling for military forces, U.S. military forces, to at least be on the border of Venezuela.
Right.
What's been the response from Washington?
The response from Washington has been more careful than that. The White House has only said they are monitoring the situation and that they support Guaido in his effort to get the military to rise up, join him, and overthrow this government. What Scott is calling for is a little bolder, a little scarier to some people. He's called for this before. What he's calling for is for the U.S. military to be assembled on the border in Colombia to take humanitarian aid into the country, not to invade it militarily. But the problem is, technically, that would still be a U.S. military incursion into Venezuela.
Have we heard from Senator Rubio's?
He's been tweeting all morning, ever since Guaido released his video at dawn this morning. Rubio has been tweeting things, warning the military that today you can no longer be a bystander. This may be your final chance to make the right choice. Do not let this moment slip away. It may not come again, et cetera, et cetera. So he's sort of helping Guaido in this effort to drill into the heads of the military leaders that, look, this is a doomed regime. Come over to our side now.
Is this a situation where Guaido has to get Maduro out now? If not, what happens?
The risk here is that Guaido and the opposition may be overplaying their hand. And if they do that, they may be sort of cutting the branch, the limb that they've gone out on from underneath them. And they may not get a chance to do more substantive negotiation with the military that's going to be required to achieve regime change in Venezuela. They wanted to try something very bold and dramatic today because they fear that this movement to get rid of the Maduro regime has sort of been losing momentum. I can understand why they wanted to do something dramatic, but they have to be careful not to overplay their hand, or they're going to find themselves not having lost their leverage with the Venezuelan military to get it to come over to their side. And worse, they could end up behind bars.
I've seen the videos on the news. Protesters out in the parts of Caracas right now in clashes with the military. This is a story that we'll just keep following. Tim, thank you so much.
It's going to last. Thank you, Lewis.
Again, talking with WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. We will keep you updated on that story in Venezuela. Still to come, how are the melting polar ice caps impacting hurricanes? That's coming up next here on Sundial.
Patrona del clavo, dame protección. Bendice a mi pueblo en tu corazón. Bendice a mi pueblo en tu corazón.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Scientists have long been documenting the melting of polar ice caps. It's happening all over the globe. Over the past 100 years, the number of glaciers in Glacier National Park has gone from 150 to 30. The snow atop Mount Kilimanjaro has decreased 80% in the same time. Scientists predict over the past three decades alone, they say over the past three decades alone, Arctic sea ice has declined by 10%. Now, the impact of melting polar ice is being felt far away from the Arctic tundra, even here in South Florida. Dr. Jennifer Francis is a senior researcher at the Woodhulls Research Facility. The impact of melting polar ice caps on storms has recently become a hot-button issue, and it's one that she's put her focus on. She's going to be at Books and Books in Coral Gables tonight for an event, and she joins us now from WXEL Studios in Boynton Beach. Dr. Francis, I appreciate the time.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
When did the scientific community begin to look at the impacts of climate change and especially Arctic melting on the impacts of hurricanes?
Well, it's actually a very new area of research, connecting what's been going on in the Arctic with extreme weather of all sorts. So not just hurricanes, but storms up in the northern parts of the United States, and also droughts and heat waves and all kinds of extreme events. And I do want to correct one thing that you said. Over the last three or four decades, the Arctic sea ice has diminished by half, not by 10%.
Thank you for the correction.
A huge change. So, and we're looking at the Arctic warming 2 to 3 times faster than the rest of the globe. And we'll talk about what that means for extreme weather.
So is there a correlation then? Can we say there is a correlation between, you know, climate change, but especially when we're talking about the Arctic melting to hurricanes?
Yes, we can. And I'll try to explain in simple terms of what we think is going on. So first of all, everybody needs to recognize that the fuel that drives hurricanes is really the heat in the atmosphere and the heat in the ocean and the water vapor in the atmosphere. And as we're warming the earth, because we're increasing the amount of so-called greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, particularly carbon dioxide, we are warming the oceans, we're warming the air, and because of that, we're seeing more evaporation from the oceans, and that's putting more water vapor into the atmosphere. That water vapor is incredibly important because when it condenses into clouds, it releases heat into the atmosphere, and hurricanes especially feed off that heat. So by warming the globe, we're increasing the fuel available for hurricanes to become stronger. So the connection to the Arctic here is that as we lose all that sea ice and snow up in the Arctic area, you can think of it as we're losing the Earth's mirror. The Arctic ice and the snow cover reflect a lot of the sun's energy right back to outer space, so it never enters the climate system at all. But by losing all that snow and ice, we're now absorbing a lot more of that energy into the Earth's climate system. And it's been estimated in some recent studies that global warming is between 25 and 40% higher because of the loss of sea ice and snow in the Arctic. So by losing this mirror in the Arctic, we're increasing global warming, we're adding to the warming of the oceans, and we're providing more fuel for hurricanes. So what we think that's going to translate to, and what we've already seen in some of the past several decades, is a tendency for more of the strongest hurricanes, so Category 4 and 5, and also a tendency for these storms to intensify more rapidly.
Let's look at two specifically, Florence and Harvey, Hurricanes Florence and Harvey. In what ways can we say that everything that you've been talking about and these changes in our atmosphere impacted the way Florence and Harvey behaved?
Right. And there's another element that I haven't talked about yet. But just on the to start with, Harvey became intense very, very rapidly just before it came ashore. And that is a very difficult thing for hurricane forecasters to predict, is the speed of that intensification. The other very unusual thing about Harvey is that it stopped when it got to the coast, and it just stayed in one place for a couple of days and dumped over 50 inches of rain in the Houston area. So one of the contributions of climate change to that story is that rapid intensification, and also all that extra water vapor in the atmosphere is tending to make not just hurricanes, but all storms dump more moisture, dump more rain onto wherever they happen to hit. So Hurricane Harvey came into the coast and stopped, and Florence did exactly the same thing. And Florence also dumped incredible amounts of rain onto the Carolinas, also contributed by the very warm waters off of the Carolinas and the extra water vapor in the atmosphere.
And now, then you look at Hurricane Michael, because you talked about increasing intensity so quickly. Michael, and it was just recently upgraded from a Category 4 to a 5, and within 24 hours, it was in the Gulf of Mexico, within 24 hours, it just became this massive, powerful storm.
Yes, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. The intensification of hurricanes has been documented as happening much more rapidly, and that's expected to increase even further in the future. And the intensity of tropical storms is still a very difficult thing for hurricane forecasters to predict, because it's not just related to the temperature of the ocean, but it's how deep that layer of ocean is warm. And so if you have a shallow layer of warm water sitting on top of, say, a colder layer, then there's not that much energy available for the storm. But if that layer is very deep, then it can provide a lot of energy for that storm. And we just don't have the data to tell us how deep those layers are in many cases. So that's a huge area of research that's happening right now, is to try to do a better job of understanding where those deep heat layers are, so that, because that affects the intensification of the storm so dramatically.
I'm talking with Dr. Jennifer Francis, senior researcher at the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts. She's focused on the impact of melting polar ice caps on hurricanes. She will be at Books and Books tonight for an event, and we have the details on our social media, WLRN Sundial, if in case you're interested to check it out. You were talking about it's difficult to predict, those factors that help in building the intensity of the storm. I wanted to ask you about, there's research coming out of Rutgers University where they have basically developed some sort of autonomous vehicle that they're putting in the ocean to measure water temperatures. Is this part of trying to understand that, getting that data?
Yes, it is, absolutely. And they're at one of the forefront universities working on this particular project. So they've developed an underwater autonomous vehicle, or a glider, that they can set off on its own with a pre-programmed course to follow, or they can guide it from land and steer it right into the paths of tropical storms as they're coming up the coast, so that they can get a much better understanding of exactly how much heat there is available in that upper layer of the ocean, how deep that heat extends. And that will make a big difference to the accuracy of the intensification of these storms.
Is that different information than what the hurricane hunter planes are already trying to gather when they're flying through storms and they're dropping, I guess, different sensors out into the storm and in the water to see what's going on?
Yeah, so hurricane hunters generally drop what's called a drop sonde, and that is mainly designed to measure what's going on in the atmosphere and not so much down deeper into the ocean. So those drop sondes are sort of like a weather balloon, but instead of being let off from the land and they float up through the atmosphere, they're dropped from an airplane, and they can do that at a much higher density in space, and they get a lot more detailed information about the storm. And that's why they're doing that from those airplanes flying into tropical storms.
So we've seen, as mentioned at the beginning of this segment, that over the last 40, 50 years, these incredible changes in our polar regions, and it just, it begs the question, what can we expect of hurricane tracks and hurricane intensity if those polar caps continue to melt?
Well, one aspect we haven't talked about yet is the steering of hurricanes. And this is another way that the melting Arctic is playing a role, but it's also a very new research topic. It's one that I and a lot of people around the world now are working on. And what we think is happening is that because, as I mentioned, the Arctic is warming so much faster than elsewhere, it's the difference in temperature between the Arctic and areas farther south that create the what we call the jet stream, which is a fast-moving river of air that travels around the northern hemisphere. It creates storms and it steers storms, including tropical storms. And as we warm the Arctic faster than elsewhere, we're seeing the winds of the jet stream weaken, and we're also seeing the jet stream take bigger swings northward and southward. And we think what's happening is because those waves are, we're seeing those very wavy patterns happening more often, those big waves also move much more slowly from west to east. And so they're tending to set up these patterns in the atmosphere that can cause tropical storms to basically get stuck in place. We saw this with Hurricane Sandy, where it got steered in a very unusual course because of one of these very large waves in the jet stream. And we saw this happen also with Florence, where one of these large waves basically sent it into South Carolina, but then left it high and dry with no winds at all to steer it. So we're seeing these very interesting erratic behaviors of tracks of tropical storms, especially late season storms. So think Sandy and think Florence. And we expect that to be a bigger issue as we go forward in time and the ice continues to melt and the atmosphere continues to warm.
Does that mean that we would probably also see hurricanes hitting different parts of the country that we're usually not used to seeing?
Yes, that's probably going to be true as well, because as the oceans warm, hurricanes can survive farther north. So as they travel, say, up along the East Coast, instead of transitioning to a non-tropical storm, they can stay a hurricane longer because of those much warmer ocean patterns. And so that is, you know, we'll probably see a higher frequency of hurricanes hitting states that are farther north than you'd typically see them hit, especially late in the season.
Have our efforts to slow down the carbon emissions had any effect, or do we just see again do we see the glaciers, do we see the polar caps still melting away?
Well, of course, everything that we're doing to help that situation does make a difference. So switching over to renewable energy sources, you know, everything we can do to not burn fossil fuels is going to help. But sadly, what's happened so far is nowhere near enough to turn around this trajectory that we're on in terms of warming and melting. In fact, this year, emissions hit an all-time high, and we're right now the amount of carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere is the highest it's been in 3 million years. The last time there was this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the oceans were 20 meters higher. So this is the trajectory that we're on. And that's why we're hearing so many people come out and really being concerned about not doing enough soon enough. And we really do need to get behind this ball and cut down the emissions to zero if possible. And that's going to require some big changes in our energy structure of our economy, not just for us, but around the world.
What are the next steps for your research? Where are the greatest opportunities, you know, on this issue that we can learn more and do more?
Well, I'm focused on continuing to understand how the rapidly changing Arctic is affecting not just storms, but all sorts of weather extremes. We've seen much worse heat waves striking all around the Northern Hemisphere in the last few summers. We've seen much more extreme droughts. We've seen flooding. The East Coast had the wettest winter on record. So all sorts of extremes. And in different seasons and in different parts of the Northern Hemisphere, we're learning that there are different mechanisms that make this connection between the rapidly warming Arctic and these types of extreme weather in different parts of the Northern Hemisphere. So there's still a lot to learn. The atmosphere is a very complicated, chaotic system, and so it's a very difficult task to try to untangle this particular factor affecting extreme weather, while a lot of other changes are happening simultaneously in the system. So untangling these various factors is a real challenge. It's going to keep us busy for a while.
Dr. Jennifer Francis, senior researcher at the Woods Hole Research Center in Massachusetts. She's at Books and Books tonight. We have details on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Dr. Francis, thank you so much for the time.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
And again, she joined us from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach. Well, still to come, a new musical about a percussion-driven Afro-Venezuelan band playing now at the Colony Theater. You've been hearing them all program. More on that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, those are the pulses and beats that you would hear in the streets of a small remote village nestled in the jungle of Venezuela called El Clavo. The city's culture and music is encapsulated in a new musical, Viva la Paranda, which is running now at the Colony Theater, Miami Beach, and it reveals the story of a small folkloric Afro-Caribbean band that emerged in the midst of violence. In the music, lead singer Betsaida Machado and the band Paranda El Clavo teach the audience about the significance of the Afro-Venezuelan tradition La Paranda, which the band describes as caroling. The musical is in Spanish with English subtitles. It also exposes the effects of Venezuela's humanitarian crisis and tells so much. And by the way, it's immersive. You as the audience, you may actually be involved in it. Joining me now is the musical's director, Juan Suki. He joins us in studio. Juan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
You know what? I had to start with this because, you know, we were talking about Venezuela just a moment ago.
I heard, yeah.
And you were in the other room and I saw you move closer to the radio to hear. But everything that's happening kind of has this interesting impact on what you're doing on stage.
Definitely. I mean, it's a circle, you know. What we do is affected by it. And I think also the fact of having a community like this sharing their vision and their experience of what's going on in Venezuela right now, it also feeds people who are here and have left the country and are living it from outside. So I think we're all pretty sensitive to what's going on and are totally affected by it no matter where we are, you know.
This is a fascinating show because, again, it's immersive. People can be involved. Food is involved.
Totally.
Video.
Yeah.
It's not your typical theater show. How do you describe it to somebody who hasn't seen it yet?
I think it's an experience, you know. It definitely has elements from documentary. It has elements from musical. It has an element from the gathering, you know. Like when you go to El Clavo, the signature get-together in El Clavo is what happens in the show, you know. There is a soup cooking. This soup is made out of whatever each member of the community has and can bring to the table.
And it's called
Sancocho.
Sancocho.
Sancocho, yeah. And Sancocho is a slow cooking meal, you know? So it goes very much against the idea of sitting down, my meal is ready, I ate my meal and I leave, you know? Sancocho, you wait for a couple of hours or more for it to be ready. And in that time you sing and you tell stories and you share your experiences. And that's what it is about.
Describe the tradition of La Paranda.
Well, La Paranda has many meanings, you know. You can define a party by the name of La Paranda, but in this specific case, the Paranda is a community group, it's a music group that carols around town, you know, plays house concerts on very specific dates. They go on every January 1st. This Paranda, January 1st is their big day. And on any January 1st, they'll play over 120 concerts that day, house by house, and then the whole village waits for them in the main square. When you say that in a town of 1,500, that's basically playing every house almost, you know.
Now, how is it, because, you know, we talked about the Sancocho,
Yeah.
Which, by the way, you are making sancocho on the stage.
During the show.
During
of course,
the show.
Yeah.
And then is everybody going to be able to partake in enjoying it?
Oh, definitely. You're going to partake since you enter, because when you enter, you're going to smell a theater that is like that smells like a sancocho, which is a very uncommon experience. And then you're going to spend the whole show smelling how it feels more and more ready, and then you get to eat it, of course, at the end of the show.
And that adds something to the show, because you don't think of theater and using your sense of smell.
Yeah.
It's mostly what you hear and see.
Yeah. I think the theater, Michelle Hausmann's the theater artistic director, has said it in a way that I think it's beautiful, you know. They, from moment number one, agreed to do this show, and they said the process was not going to be about the group or the show adapting to the theater, but about the theater adapting to the story we were telling. And they basically committed to that, and I have to say that's exactly what they did. So the stage is transformed into a common space that looks and feels like El Clavo and smells like El Clavo and sounds like El Clavo.
And you also, I mean, again, you have video, so there's multimedia, and you even bring some people up to dance.
Yeah.
So now they're not sitting, they're dancing. They're part of the show.
Yeah, it all happens pretty naturally, you know. It's an interesting story with this community, because being an outsider, being the only person in the show who was not born in El Clavo, I have to say that from the first time I went to the village, I was so amazed by how inclusive they are. And that's exactly how they roll. You know, if you are in my town, well, you better walk into my house and see what we're cooking and try it and drink the contra that I prepare, which is like their own blends of rum with spices. And it's a community that is incredibly open. And I think there was no other way to do the show, you know.
How did you end up going down there? How did you end up in that community?
It's a long story, but I'll tell you my best attempt at the short version. I was working with Cesar Miguel Rondon, who is a radio anchor from Venezuela. And he invited me to a project where Betsaida was partaking and singing. And I was so amazed by her voice. The first time I heard her, I felt this is the most powerful voice I've heard in the world. And it doesn't sound like someone who went to Juilliard for singing. It sounds like someone who is like a bridge for the sounds of the earth to come out into the world, you know. And immediately I was so shocked. And I, why do you sing like this? Where did you learn to sing like this? Well, my dad was a street trumpet player. I come from a little village. Everyone sings there. Everybody dances. So can we go? Can we go? Can we go? Can we go? And we kept working together for a long time. And maybe a year and a half after, we finally found a day where it was okay for her to take me, and it was okay for me to go. And she said, okay, I'm buying 3 kilos of meat. You're buying 3 kilos of meat. I'm bringing potato. You're bringing yam. I'm bringing this. You're bringing that. We're going to cook a sancocho, and we're going to sing. And it was a life-changing moment for me, because I come from really formal training in the arts. You know, I'm a theater director by training with an MFA at Columbia. And I did like the very formal road of a formally trained artist. And suddenly I found myself in a rural village seeing the most powerful artists I've seen in my life, you know?
And how long were you there? How long did you immerse yourself in that world so that you could bring that to the stage here?
Oh, it's been such a long process. You know, that day I went for one day. But then that day I knew that I had to come back, because that day ends. We were in a rush, you know? It's the highway that takes you there. It's pretty tough. It's pretty dangerous. So we see the day is starting to become night, and the bus driver is like, hey, we need to go, we need to go, we need to go. And the very last question I get to ask is like, how long have you been doing this? And I learned that day that they've been doing it for 30 years and never recorded a song. I had never produced an album in my life or done anything, but I grew up in record stores. So I said, I'm coming back to this town, and we're bringing friends, and we're recording this music in here.
You, you're premiering this in a city with a large Venezuelan population. I've wondered what people have been saying to you.
It's been, I'm so happy, you know, about what's going on, because when you are so immersed in work, you don't really know how it's going to bounce back until you actually show it, you know. And normally, with any other show, what happens is that you'll understand that there's an audience for that show. So maybe the elder will tell you, this was too crazy, and the young will tell you, this was this or that. And we're in a show where people, like from kids to the other, they're going, and they are, I think it's beyond the show, you know, and I think the show in itself is just not a show, it's an encounter, and I think everyone is taking it with a really open heart, and we feel really happy about that, you know.
Again, this is not, you're not sitting and watching, you are going to, as Juan says, you're going to come in, you're going to smell wonderful, tasty, delicious, and taste that delicious food, you're going to dance, you're going to be part of the show in many ways. Again, Juan Suki talking about his new musical playing at the Colony Theater. It's called Viva la Paranda. It's going to transport you with this band, Paranda El Clavo from Venezuela, that's here now in Miami. Fascinating show. Very different. Juan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And the best going forward.
Enjoy to be here.
And that's our program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.